Well, we want to... This on? All right. We want to welcome everybody out this afternoon. This is session number 166, The Psychology of Love. That paper will be presented by Doxy Hatch, who is originally from Idaho Falls. And he grew up in Provo, served a mission in Japan, and graduated from BYU. He earned his master's in developmental psychology from Columbia University and has his PhD in clinical psychology from Temple University. While at Temple, he fell in love with a classmate who's now his wife. And just later on this month, he'll begin teaching down in Dallas at MSU. And we'll also, SMU, and be going into private practice there also. And the respondent to the paper today is Dr. Melvin Hammerberg. He earned his PhD in American Civilization and also a PhD in Counseling Psychology. And he's an associate professor of American Civilization at the University of Penn. He's written a book called The Indiana Voter, 1977. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And he's done a few articles on post-traumatic stress disorder in Vietnam veterans. And he's currently on sabbatical from the University of Pennsylvania doing research here in Salt Lake City on a book called The World of the Latter-day Saints. So without further ado,
well, I have to say that I'm touched to have people here who showed up probably less because they would agree with what I'm going to say, but to show support. As I was growing up, I enjoyed a special relationship with my paternal grandmother. In fact, my brothers and sisters used to say that she loved me more than any of them. I don't know whether that was true or not, but for whatever reason, she always seemed to have a special affection for me. She used to sneak candies to me when no one else was around, take me on walks in the orchard near our house, and regale me with stories from her travels around the world. When I reached adolescence and entered a phase of rebelliousness, Grandma was able to connect with me in ways no one else could. Not much later, she entered a difficult phase of her own, senility. As her mental state grew disorganized, she became convinced that people were stealing things from her. But her suspiciousness never came to be focused on me. Somehow, our relationship endured to the end of her life, with minimal disruptions. I tell you this as a backdrop for a puzzling encounter that took place between Grandma and me. On one of her visits to our house, Grandma hugged me and told me she loved me, as she had many times before. It felt natural for me to tell her I loved her too, but her response shocked me. She said emphatically, "You don't know what love is." I was never sure whether she was questioning the legitimacy of my professed love or assuring me that she loved me more than I could imagine. In retrospect, I think Grandma was probably right. Although I believe the tremendous love I felt for her was genuine, my understanding of love was very rudimentary at that time. And though I still wouldn't claim to have it all figured out, in the years since that encounter, I've devoted a lot of thought to the topic of love. Recognizing my own susceptibility to love's powerful effects, I believe I've been motivated by a desire to bring some sense of order to what can otherwise seem like a chaotic experience. Over the years, I've been fascinated by such questions as, what distinguishes genuine love from related phenomena or counterfeit versions? What is love for another person based on? Once it has developed, is love transitory or enduring? If love is enduring, why do so many relationships fail? Is love a reliable guide in choosing a marriage partner? Are there different types of love? With these questions as a point of departure, I propose to use my time in this session as a forum for a fairly personal account of the course along which my understanding of love has evolved. Since this evolution has been inextricably entwined with my understanding of the gospel and the ways that understanding has changed, much of what I plan to say amounts to a confession of my particular package of faith and doubts. Let me warn you. My conceptual journey has been a tortuous one, and it will be a while before I get to my conclusions about love. I believe it was primarily my interest in the topic of love and relationships that led me to pursue psychology as a career path. As a student of psychology, I learned that the most widely accepted ways of conceptualizing love among social scientists are based on psychoanalysis and behaviorism. Many of you are probably familiar with the basic concepts of these general theories of human nature. Behaviorism posits that our behavior is controlled by the consequences that follow our acts. When our behaviors are followed by rewards, we tend to repeat them. When our behaviors are followed by punishments, we tend not to. This process is referred to as conditioning. In the framework of behaviorism, love is conceptualized as a conditioned emotional response toward another person. According to behaviorists, the response we call love develops when another person's presence repeatedly coincides with gratification of some basic human need or desire. In this view, love emerges as the beloved comes to stand as a signal that some reward or another is available. Our feelings toward the beloved, therefore, are based on associative ties that form in our minds between him or her and the desired reward, not on any qualities intrinsic to the beloved as a person. And declarations of devotion notwithstanding, our true concern in the case of love is with what's in it for us. Behaviorism's narrow focus on specific behaviors and consequences is the reason it's sometimes described as a reductionist approach to explaining human behavior. The basic model on which behaviorism is based is that of a laboratory animal. Humans react to rewards and punishments with consistent, predictable responses. I will discuss the notion of conceptual models in more detail later on. Psychoanalysis contrasts sharply with behaviorism in many ways, but there are also some similarities. In traditional psychoanalytic theory, individuals are assumed to be motivated by powerful instinctual drives. The drive that tends to receive the most attention in psychoanalytic theory, and which is held to be the impetus behind most social behavior, is Eros, the sex drive. But psychoanalytic theory tends not to view human behavior as a simple expression of underlying drives. Because many impulses represent a threat to social order or personal comfort, they tend to be repressed or sublimated. In repression, unacceptable thoughts or feelings are dammed up in a sort of unconscious reservoir. This is said to be the fate of most of the sexual feelings we might have toward those not considered appropriate as potential sexual partners. The traditional psychoanalytic theory of love is based on the concept of sublimation. Because unharnessed sexuality is perceived as dangerous, even when directed toward a potentially appropriate partner, sexual attraction toward another person may be transformed into more innocuous and socially acceptable courtship behavior. From this perspective, the elaborate medieval codes of chivalry and courtly love, from which our notions of romantic love arise, represent ways of modulating the raw sex drive. Thus, the keen interest a lover takes in the well-being of his or her beloved is merely the external manifestation of a more basic, selfish desire to gratify sexual impulses. Although psychoanalytic explanations of human behaviors tend to be less reductionistic than those of behaviorism, like behaviorism, psychoanalysis was originally based on a simple model of human nature. Freud's description of instinctual energy pressing for an outlet and being shunted into various channels and chambers, conscious and unconscious, closely parallels the workings of a steam engine. I've characterized the major psychological explanations of love as briefly as possible, committing in the process the offense of gross oversimplification, in the hope that you will begin to see why these explanations weren't entirely satisfactory to me as a Mormon and a Christian. Aside from their extensive and sometimes acrimonious differences, psychoanalysis and behaviorism share a common assumption of selfishness as fundamental to human nature. That's probably okay so far as it goes. Selfishness is pretty pervasive in what we can observe of human nature. In a sense, these two theories are explanations of the concerns that motivate what King Benjamin described as the natural man. The problem is that in Christian thought, love is supposed to represent a departure from the human nature these two theories describe. As Paul wrote, "Love seeketh not her own." It is through love that we are encouraged to rise above narrow self-interest to higher, more noble concerns. I believe that this transcendent dimension of love is the reason love is so central to the Christian gospel. It is the essence of spirituality. As Jesus pointed out, all the law and the prophets hinge on love. Rather than identifying love as an area in which their explanations don't apply, however, psychoanalysis and behaviorism treat it as just another case of routine, albeit disguised, selfishness. It's easy to see why these schools of thought would reject love as a transcendent phenomenon. Not to do so would jeopardize their status as comprehensive scientific accounts of human behavior. But to my mind, these theories' failure to acknowledge the human potential to transcend self-interest makes them inadequate as explanations for love. For this and other reasons, the further I progressed in my professional training, the more I came to sense a discontinuity between my identity as a Mormon and my identity as a psychologist. I felt that if my training in the academy required me to set aside my beliefs in a supernatural reality, even temporarily, then surely I would be justified in taking up concepts offered by the academy in a provisional, hypothetical spirit. In the course of my training, I became an expert at conceptualizing things from a given perspective without necessarily accepting that perspective as valid. I learned how to suspend judgment and entertain conflicting ideas one at a time as an exercise in hypothetical reasoning. I was encouraged in viewing social science truths as tentative by what I learned about epistemology and the philosophy of science. In fact, over a period of time, my entire intellectual outlook was revolutionized by a better understanding of these related disciplines. Epistemology is the branch of philosophy concerned with how we know what we know. Whereas in the past, knowledge was conceptualized as a faithful mental copy of one chunk of reality produced by direct interaction with that reality, contemporary epistemologists have been arguing for a more nuanced, contextual understanding of knowledge. They point out that one's experience of a given reality is influenced by a myriad of factors, such as culture, language, age, gender, even mood. Thus, a particular reality doesn't present itself to any two individuals in exactly the same way. Contemporary epistemologists say that's because we don't act as passive receptacles for knowledge. Rather, in our day-to-day efforts to anticipate what's coming next and act appropriately, we're continually constructing models of reality. We then draw on those models to guide us in negotiating our world. This approach to epistemology is frequently called constructivism. In the past several decades, constructivism has supplanted traditional literal-minded approaches to become the generally accepted approach to epistemology. The insights of constructivism have also had far-reaching implications for the philosophy of science. Whereas the scientific enterprise used to be viewed as the discovery of natural laws, constructivist epistemology led to the view of science as an exercise in constructing systematic models of various aspects of the world and then testing their validity. In this context, validity is a question of utility rather than one of objective truth. Because our contacts with reality are inevitably colored by past experience, mediated by the physical apparatus of our organs of sensation, and shaped by the language we use to reflect on and describe them, no scientific statement of what is can ever be more than an approximation. Typically, scientific research on poorly understood phenomena proceeds by comparing them to phenomena that are already more or less familiar. For example, when similarities were recognized between the movement of electricity and the flow of rivers, the term current was extended from its familiar concrete sense and applied to electricity in a metaphorical sense. This approach has proved remarkably fruitful, serving as the basis for many of the most important technological advances of this century. Unfortunately, there's a tendency for us to mistake the models we use to understand the world for the world itself. For example, although the term current has been given a precise technical definition in modern electronics, by definition, electricity flows in currents, that doesn't mean, of course, that electricity and rivers are the same thing. However similar two phenomena might be in some respects, there are always other respects in which they differ. And for this reason, no one model can serve perfectly as an explanatory device. Different models are always required to elucidate different aspects of a given phenomenon. In short, as Alfred Korzybski put it, the map is not the territory. To forget this point is not only to misunderstand how scientific theories are developed, but to grant science and scientists an authority they cannot legitimately claim. After all, the history of scientific progress has been one of repeated theoretical alterations and reconceptualizations in all the most important areas of scientific inquiry. Now, if you think back to what I said earlier about the models of human nature on which behaviorism and psychoanalysis are based, you can see how each of them was derived from their originator's own life experiences. B.F. Skinner, the father of behaviorism, generated his ideas about human behavior from his work with laboratory animals. Similarly, Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, patterned his account of human psychological functioning on the model of that prototypical example of Victorian technology, the steam engine. Recognizing both behaviorism and psychoanalysis as culturally embedded creations of the men who claimed to discover them, and in light of these theories' shortcomings as explanations for love, it might occur to you, as it did to me, that more promising alternative models are readily available in religious teachings. Emboldened by the liberating conceptual framework provided by constructivism, I set out to formulate a theory of love based on an alternative model. Although initially I wasn't sure what form the new model would take, I wanted it to represent the perspective on love I had found so powerful in my Mormon upbringing. In this endeavor, I was motivated not only by a desire to understand love better, but also by a furtive hope that I could forge a reconciliation between the apparently incompatible worldviews of Mormonism and psychology. Although I had been rewarded with valuable insights as a result of my study in both of these traditions, my intellectual wanderings back and forth between camps had left me somewhat confused about my true ideological home. By marrying together the insights of each of these traditions, therefore, I hope to make an honest man of myself, both as a psychologist and as a Mormon. I realized I was taking a chance of alienating myself from one or the other tradition, or both, but I had already begun to feel like an infidel pretender in both camps, as it was. It had reached a point where I didn't have much to lose. You can tell that this makes me nervous. Before reporting on what course my efforts at reconciliation took, I have to warn you that the outcome didn't turn out to be altogether orthodox. The perspective I've come to embrace with regard to love places me distinctly outside the mainstreams of both Mormonism and psychology. I still sometimes wonder whether there's a place for me in either. I'll leave it for you to judge whether my peace was purchased at too high a price. At any rate, I have devoted so much time to my story, to the story of how I arrived at my current understanding of love, so that you could see for yourself all the ground I've traversed. If you disapprove of any of the turns I've taken, you can part company with me, ideologically speaking, so as not to be led the rest of the way down the path. In keeping with what I've said about the tentative nature of scientific knowledge, I make no claim to authoritative knowledge about love merely by virtue of my training as a psychologist. I have to point out one more implication of constructivist epistemology before turning to the topic of love in earnest. My first step in formulating a spiritually informed theory of love was to get back in touch with what I really believed already. I returned to the scriptures to see what they had to say, not only about the unselfish nature of love, which I've already noted, but particularly to see what kind of explanation they offered for such love. It was only when I began to take the scriptures seriously as a source of explanations for love that it really hit me that all the revolutionary implications constructivism had for scientific theories apply equally to religious dogma. In the same way that scientists proceed by constructing and refining theoretical models of their chosen subjects, prophets and theologians also use models to represent their subject matter. In our own Mormon canon, for example, God is described not only as a father figure, but also as a king, a judge, and in the Song of Solomon, as a lover. It would take more time than I have to examine these models of God in detail, or to scrutinize the grounds on which we regard some as true only in a metaphorical sense, while we uncritically accept others as statements of literal fact. Suffice it to say that we have to rely on conceptual models to help us understand spiritual phenomena as well as natural ones. It may seem like a clear declaration of faithlessness faithlessness on my part for me to suggest that we have to use metaphors whenever we speak about the divine, even if this is the case when we speak of natural phenomena. I hasten to point out that this notion has already been articulated by individuals with far better ecclesiastical credentials than mine. In fact, even discussing love and epistemology in the same context is not my own innovation. I don't think it's any accident that Paul closes what is probably the most famous discourse on love ever written with a remarkably pessimistic appraisal of what we can know, even about spiritual matters. You'll recall that he compares our view of reality to seeing through a glass darkly. He also says that our knowledge shall vanish away. The important point is that while we can receive confirmation that there is a spiritual dimension to our world, we can never pin down that dimension in any definitive way. George Santayana put it well. Our knowledge is a torch of smoky pine that lights the pathway but one step ahead, across a void of mystery and dread. He concludes, "Bid then the tender light of faith to shine, by which alone the soul is led unto the thinking of the thought divine." If our knowledge of spiritual matters were infallible, there would be no need for faith. But given the constraints on our knowledge of spiritual truth, faith is so important that it is recognized as the first principle of the gospel. And as the kind of people who listen to alternate voices like mine already know, faith is not a rigid clinging to creeds formulated by committees. Faith is living true to the glimpses of eternity with which we are blessed in times of attunement. The realization that we understand not only the physical world, but also the divine, through the cognitive mediation of models, set into motion the second half of the revolution in my intellectual orientation that had begun with my questioning the definitiveness of scientific knowledge. Rather than leading me further along the path of cynicism and disillusionment, however, this new orientation awakened me to the sources of truth all around that I had never taken seriously before. You see, the recognition that knowledge is metaphorical in nature leads to the ecumenical notion, regarded with suspicion by most mainstream Mormons, that models of reality can differ from each other and still be equally legitimate. In fact, the truth can never be represented definitively by any one model. That's why we rely on more than one model of God, even in our own Mormon theology. With the barriers traditionally separating both one religion from another and religion in general from science finally deconstructed, I could see for the first time that all truth really can be circumscribed into one great whole. Furthermore, once the groundwork was in place for me to reunify my fractured worldview, I found myself able once again to accept gospel principles gratefully and enthusiastically without having to agonize over their legitimacy as descriptions of real events and processes. Thus, epistemology turned out to be my path to grace. And in a sense, everything that follows is merely a footnote to the epistemological reorientation I have described, a working out of the details. But since many of you probably came here specifically to hear something about love, this is the time to make good on my promise to report to you my conclusions about love. Speaking as a skeptical, atheistic social scientist, Sigmund Freud raised the critical questions about love with characteristic incisiveness. Referring to the biblical injunction to love thy neighbor as thyself, he wrote, "Why should we do it? What good will it do us? But above all, how shall we achieve it? How can it be possible? What is the point of a precept enunciated with so much solemnity if its fulfillment cannot be recommended as reasonable?" Perhaps the first scriptural answer to Freud's questions is offered in Leviticus. When the Hebrew nation was enjoined to love the strangers in their land, the commandment was followed up with a curt explanation. "For ye were strangers in the land of Egypt." The basic rationale offered here for going out of one's way for someone who presumably has nothing to offer in return is an appeal to commonalities between oneself and the other. To the extent that one can identify with the other, helping him or her is merely taking the action one would desire the other to take if the situation were reversed. This is the same logic that underlies the golden rule, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." Living in a community in which people tend to help others can be advantageous to everyone involved, even if it requires some occasional self-sacrifice. Thus, the scriptural answer to the question, why love, turns the focus away from potential benefits to the lover to interests common to both parties involved. But this explanation for love becomes more problematic when there's no apparent common ground between the parties. In the New Testament, for example, Jesus made the commandment to love others more demanding by teaching his followers that they must love everyone, including their enemies. What possible justification could there be for such a potentially self-defeating policy? The mainstream Mormon answer to that question posits a common ground that links all humanity. Not only do we regard God as a loving, universal Father, but as his children, we recognize each other and all other humans as brothers and sisters. We are therefore obligated to extend our love to all people out of deference for God's love for them. Moreover, it makes sense for us to do so because they are our spiritual kin, sharing with us a common divine ancestry. The mainstream Mormon model of universal kinship is both better elaborated and more widely applicable than the simple idea that one should act charitably toward those who occupy a situation one has previously occupied oneself. But the notion that we are all spiritual siblings leaves something to be desired as an explanation for romantic love. At best, it suggests why squabbles are inevitable even in the best romantic matches. At worst, it serves as a potential endorsement for incest. When it comes to romantic love, we tend to minimize the familial aspects of our relatedness. We're fond of reciting a particular passage from the Old Testament as evidence of a divine mandate for marriage. Quote, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." But standing alone, as it usually does, this statement is incomplete. The part of the record that explains why one should get married is routinely omitted. The neglected antecedent to this injunction to marry is the rib story. "And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib, which the Lord God had taken from man, made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Now, we may differ in terms of how literally we take this account of the creation of Eve, but the rationale it offers for man's identification with woman and for his consequent interest in her well-being is her derivation as a part of him. The phrase, "they shall be one flesh," is both descriptive and prescriptive in its metaphorical richness. In its most concrete sense, it conjures up an image of a couple engaged in the sexual embrace that defines their relationship as conjugal. But it also refers back to the rib story in which Eve was made from part of Adam's flesh. Perhaps most significantly, this statement stands as a declaration that a man and woman who come together as a couple are to be recognized as making up a family, every bit as legitimate as one defined by blood ties. It's worth pointing out that in a very concrete sense, women's exclusive ability to bear children makes them, not men, the obvious source for all human life. This fact is often alluded to as an explanation for a more righteous, loving nature attributed to them, as in the phrase, "a face only a mother could love." Thus, the rib story also serves as a compensatory myth to provide men with a stake they might otherwise lack in humanity's, and especially women's, well-being. The idea that men should love women because women are derived from men, or the converse, is somewhat different from the family model of relatedness among individuals more common in mainstream Mormon theology. The differences make it both more primitive and concrete, but also more appropriate as a model for romantic love. Notwithstanding differences in the specific forms these two models take, however, the basic point conveyed by both models is the same. There are connections between us that are not apparent on the surface, and when we keep these in mind, we will approach each other with the love appropriate for such kindred spirits. The Judeo-Christian tradition is not the only source of religious models of relatedness. In fact, Eastern religious thought tends to offer even more radical views of relatedness among individuals than those found in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Drawing on the framework of Hinduism, Indian religious philosopher Meher Baba teaches that our very separateness as individuals is merely an illusion. According to him, all of us represent parts of an all-inclusive whole that constitutes God. Love is the name we give to the experience of recognizing others as parts of our true self, a self which encompasses the entire universe. As Meher Baba puts it, love is the reflection of God's unity in the world of duality. Now, this perspective tends to sound foreign to Mormons, but it's not without precedent in the Christian tradition. Paul taught something very similar when he wrote to the saints at Corinth. As the body is one and hath many members, and all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. Now are ye the body of Christ, and members in particular. The idea of a more or less pervasive spiritual unity also helps make sense of parts of Jesus' intercessory prayer that are otherwise utterly confusing. I pray that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they may be one in us. I in them, and thou in me, that they may be perfect in one. In fact, the notion of a unity between God and the individual, and among humankind in general, is one of the most consistent and universal themes in the teachings of mystics from every religious tradition. On the basis of my scriptural review, I came to conceptualize love as the experience of attunement to an underlying unity linking all individuals. In this conceptualization, the underlying unity is posited to be in place all the time. Our attunement to it, however, waxes and wanes, accounting for the ups and downs we all experience in our relationships with others. Thus, at the times we feel love for another person, we are actually discovering connections between ourselves and the other that have been there all along. If this formulation sounds like Saturday's warrior philosophizing, that's not entirely coincidental. On the other hand, because of its generic form, this model has certain advantages over the traditional Protestant belief in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. I've already pointed out how this model avoids the traditional Mormon mixed metaphors that places simultaneously in the contradictory roles of siblings and sexual partners. Because this model doesn't depend on all the elaborate assumptions associated with the doctrine that we are spiritual siblings, it's also more parsimonious and therefore more easily integrated with other perspectives. In fact, such a model dovetails with recent theoretical advances in biological research, in which the boundaries that distinguish individual identity from group identity have begun to blur. It has been observed, for example, that although individual ants are capable of moving around individually, in many ways, it is only in concert with the rest of the colony that they function as complete organisms. After all, most members of the colony aren't even capable of reproducing themselves. In the same way that Paul enumerated distinctive gifts distributed among the members that make up the body of Christ, different tasks necessary to the functioning of an ant colony are performed by different individual ants. The fact that groups of humans often function as a coordinated unit, with individuals taking on distinctive but complementary roles, has also been observed by many family therapists and organizational behavior theorists. Thus, the model of unity I'm proposing appears to have a great deal of currency in many disparate fields of study. Conceptualizing love as an experience of attunement to underlying unity has a number of implications for the questions about love that I brought up at the beginning of my talk. Let me trace some of those implications now. First of all, to the extent that one person feels love toward another on the basis of an underlying unity linking them together, it makes sense for one to act in the other's interest, even at sacrifice to his or her own interests, as long as the collective benefits to both people outweigh the collective costs. This analysis not only admits the possibility of altruistic behavior, but offers a rational explanation for it. Indeed, from this perspective, love is the driving force behind all altruism, wherever it emerges. And because love is an experience one person has with respect to another, love doesn't have to be reciprocated to be real. Scrutinizing the model of underlying unity as an explanation for altruistic love, it becomes clear that it also has potential as an account of selfish love. Insofar as the individual is considered incomplete as a functional unit, he or she needs to be engaged with others in some way, even at a cost to individual interests. In terms of the model of underlying unity, the main difference between selfish and altruistic love appears to be that while the selfish lover senses his or her incompleteness without the beloved and strives to effect union, the altruistic lover operates from a sense of assurance that an underlying unity is already in place between him or herself and the beloved. The notion that love is based on a unity that links all of humanity also has a more radical implication. Insofar as every individual member of humanity can represent the whole, the choice of love partners is logically arbitrary. The finding of social psychologists that geographical proximity, an essentially trivial factor, is the single best predictor of attraction and liking between two individuals lends support to this formulation. This formulation is also consistent with the observation of many psychotherapists that people tend to fall in love with particular partners not so much because of who the partners are as individuals, but because of what or whom they represent. While this notion may be deflating to those who like to believe that they have found or have been found as a one and only, it is consistent with the observation that most people are capable of falling in love more than once and with partners who are often very different. Most individuals seem to have the potential to be happy, or in some cases, miserable, with any number of partners. Further, although those of you who insist on being loved for who you are might object to this formulation, your view is not really contradicted by what I'm proposing. After all, stripped down to the most essential, we are all the same. It is this most essential part of our identities to which love is a response. As Antoine de Saint-Exupéry observed, it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. The paradox of this conceptualization is that although there is nothing any of us can do to make ourselves more worthy of love than the next person, each of us already possesses every attribute on which genuine love can be based. Moreover, the notion that love partners are fundamentally interchangeable also leads to the liberating implication that there's never any need to worry about a dearth of potential love partners. The view of love as an experience based on attunement to the deepest, most essential relationship between individuals deviates from traditional approaches in which love is classified into a variety of types according to whether the loved one is a parent, a potential mate, a friend, or whatever. Clearly, the interactions we share with others differ according to such variables, but such differences lie at a level more superficial than the unity on which love is based. As I conceptualize it, the experience of love can emerge in the context of any kind of interpersonal relationship, and though it is likely to affect our interactions with other people, it's neither composed of such interactions, nor does it cause them. Rather than distinguishing romantic relationships from friendships, for example, love is something that underlies both. Thus, assuming that you're experiencing love toward another person, the way to express it remains at your discretion. It is open for negotiation. For this reason, even though love can transcend gender, culture, race, and class, its expression always bears traces of those influences. Advocates for victims of various kinds will take comfort in the fact that while abusive or otherwise objectionable behavior on the part of one partner in a relationship can never disrupt the fundamental bonds on which love is based, neither does love constrain the other partner to maintain the relationship in any particular form. Finally, this model provides an explanation for a paradoxical aspect of love. Most people find that their feelings toward their partners go through ups and downs from one minute to the next, even when their basic sense of commitment to him or her remains stable. In other words, love exhibits both the characteristics of evanescence and durability. Inasmuch as the experience of love depends on our attunement to underlying unity, it is inevitably transitory. But because it is based on links that connect us at the most fundamental level, it has the potential to come to us again and again if we remain open to it. In fact, given that love is a response to the beloved as the representative of a larger, more inclusive whole, it is not affected by changes in the beloved's physical features or even personality characteristics. As Shakespeare put it, "Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom." That love could remain unchanged in the face of changes in the partner is consistent with the traditional belief that genuine love is unconditional. In short, nothing the beloved does or fails to do can alter the fundamental relatedness that binds one to him or her. Loving unconditionally tends to remain a fairly distant ideal for most of us. But if the concept of underlying unity doesn't provide the means to achieve it, at least it provides a rationale for continuing to work at it. Before closing, I want to return once more to the topic of epistemology. I cited Paul's pessimistic view of our knowledge earlier, and I said I don't think it was an accident that he concluded his discussion of love with a reference to epistemology. Paul wrote, "Whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away." Contrasting it with these imperfect and temporary epistemic mediums, however, Paul declared, "Charity never faileth." Thus, love is transcendent not only in the sense that it allows us to rise above self-interest, but also in the sense that it is perfect and enduring. I believe that what distinguishes love is that it is the one mode of knowing that involves more than mere mental models of reality. It is the one way we can engage reality directly with our whole beings. Unfortunately, the immediate nature of this kind of knowing precludes our holding on to the vision it provides after the experience is past. As John Donne put it, "Love is a growing or full constant light, and his first minute after noon is night." Viewed this way, experiencing love is equivalent to enjoying the presence of the Holy Spirit. Jesus' comment to Nicodemus is therefore relevant. "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit." Because the vitality of our knowledge fades as soon as we break contact with a particular reality, no statement of the truth can ever be quite true. And in an important sense, we can never know the truth in the sense of filing away an accurate copy of reality for future reference. We can only live the truth. For this reason, our conversions are only as valid as our last experience of love. Thus, Alma, preaching to long-standing members of the church, wasn't particularly concerned with their mastery of doctrinal niceties. For him, the crucial question was, as it should be for us, "If ye have felt to sing the song of redeeming love, can ye feel so now?"
Doxy Hatch proposes to develop an understanding of love by integrating psychological and religious approaches to human behavior. What is involved in this project is what I would call identity work. The explicit effort by an individual to establish a more or less well-grounded sense of self or personhood in a determinate world of others, persons, animals, and things, and their relationships, among which love relationships are importantly numbered. Doxy's grandmother said he didn't know what love was. That sounds like a Mormon challenge to me, and so he set out to learn. His account of his searching sets two social science approaches to human relations, behavioral psychology and Freudian psychoanalysis, over against Judeo-Christian approaches to love as understood through Latter-day Saint percepts. Admittedly, he simplifies, some may say oversimplifies, all of these approaches in order to present his version of a constructionist epistemology as a way to integrate them, resolve felt conflicts, or skirt the real issues, as the case may be. The driving force in this effort seems to be to find a way to affirm both an identity as a psychologist among a reference group of scientists and an identity as a Latter-day Saint among a reference group of church members, with the explicit fear that neither group will accept this effort at identity integration. Let me say immediately, that this project is familiar to most of us who enter the social sciences with a strong background in religious sensibilities, and it takes its form in confessional narratives, autobiographical writing, and other efforts to integrate our understandings of inner and outer worlds. I think Doxy is right, that at the core, we are faced with discrepant worldviews, and I would add as well, issues of personal and social identity and of the group cultures in which those identities are rooted. I have some difficulty with the terms of Doxy's argument, both on the psychological social science side and on the Judeo-Christian side. With respect to the first side, he characterizes behaviorism and psychoanalysis. Skinnerian behaviorism, he suggests, posits love as a conditioned emotional response to the beloved as a symbol of a reward, a view that he says can be summarized as what's in it for us. This view of Skinner's behaviorism thus posits a mentalist center of volition, which, of course, Skinner absolutely denied. Skinner denied mind and emotion as centers of a self and admitted neither internal agency nor transcendental causes, neither stimuli or responses. His was a completely physiological system of nerve impulses that transmitted sensations. To characterize this system as involving what's in it for us motives is to take a position outside of Skinner's behaviorism itself. All Skinner would say is that we are conditioned in our language to call certain kinds of other conditioned responses love. The conditioning agents are simply other human animals mutually interacting through conditioned responses themselves and the contingencies of the natural world. Freud was not quite the anti-mentalist that Skinner was, but Freud was a physician and physiologist whose full theory of personality, developed after 1913, was as much a theory of appetite dynamics as one that relied on the hydraulic metaphors suggested by the steam engine. Sublimation in the full theory is one of the defenses of the ego against the superego in the face of drives by the id, and as Doxy indicates, transforms sexual appetites into socially acceptable forms. To quote Doxy, "Thus, the keen interest a lover takes in the well-being of his or her beloved is the external manifestation of a more basic selfish desire to gratify sexual impulses." Freud would admit desire as a drive internal to the self physiologically constituted. But Freud would go further, as his case studies indicate. He would suggest that these desires are worked out in the cultural fabric of different societies and subgroups, LDS, non-LDS, Christian, non-Christian, scientific, religious, ethnic, social class, or any other. My point is that Doxy's assumption of a selfishness motive common to these two social science psychologies misrepresents Skinner and oversimplifies Freud, where what the latter calls sublimation may take culturally variable forms as a function of different culturally constituted normative codes. I also have some difficulty with Doxy's characterization of a Christian view of love as that which seeketh not her own, quoting Paul in 1 Corinthians 13. The Greek language has at least three different terms that may all be translated by the single English term love, namely eros, philia, and agape. These are terms for different kinds of love relationships, the erotic, the brotherly, the self-giving. It is the latter kind to which Paul refers in the famous Corinthian passage, which in his view is most fully modeled in the self-giving love through which Jesus as the Christ took upon himself the sins of the world. My phrasing of Paul's meaning here has a decidedly Augustinian rather than LDS cast to it. I simply want to suggest that there may be several different Judeo-Christian views of love that cannot be summarized simply as, quote, the voluntary subordination of one's own interest to those of another, end quote. Further, what Doxy later labels as altruism involves a cost-benefit analysis on a collective level that, in my view, misrepresents the agape love of which the Apostle Paul speaks. Perhaps what he labels selfish love may pass for eros, but the passion of the Greek concept is certainly missing. And whether his notion of universality can stand for the brotherly love the Greeks called philia is open to question. Thus I am unsettled by Doxy's analysis of Judeo-Christian love concepts, just as I am by the presentation of the two social science psychologies. But there is another side to this paper in which all of that is beside the point. The real issue of this paper, it seems to me, is the identity struggle represented by the efforts to characterize and reconcile different culturally constituted worldviews and the different communities of practitioners who hold them. To quote Doxy, "The further I progressed in my professional training, the more I came to sense a discontinuity between my identity as a Mormon and my identity as a psychologist. I felt that if my training in the academy required me to set aside my beliefs in a supernatural reality, even temporarily, then surely I would be justified in taking up concepts offered by the academy in a provisional hypothetical spirit." Later he indicates that, quote, "I was motivated not only by a desire to understand love better, but also by a furtive hope that I could forge a reconciliation between the apparently incompatible worldviews of Mormonism and psychology. My intellectual peregrinations back and forth between camps had left me somewhat confused about my true intellectual home. By marrying the insights of each of these traditions, therefore, I hoped to make an honest man of myself, both as a psychologist and as a Mormon." The fear in this undertaking is explicit. He indicates that he is, quote, "taking a chance of alienating myself from one or the other tradition or both," end quote, but that the price of not taking this chance is to remain, quote, "an infidel pretender in both camps," end quote. It seems to me that these statements represent the terms of an identity struggle to which none of us are immune. How does Doxy conceptualize this struggle, and can we reconceptualize the struggle itself in a way that makes clearer how it is constituted? Doxy conceptualizes his intellectual struggle over the meaning of love as involving two different worldviews set in opposition to each other by an older theory of knowledge that viewed our concepts of the world as providing a faithful copy of reality through direct observation. Under this copy theory of reality, if our conceptualizations differed, only one of them could be true for whatever domain of reality was at stake. Thus, the LDS claim that this church is the one true church stands within the framework provided by the copy theory of reality. There can be one and only one true version of any domain. The constructivist position is different. Our theories don't copy reality in any direct sense. They are, after all, mental, not physical, constructions. Further, because we actively construct different views of what's out there as our perceived reality, and our perceptions are influenced by our experience, which is shaped by age, class, race, ethnicity, gender, language, and mood, to name ones that are often cited, our constructions are limited, relative, partial. This view seems to render our theories as arbitrary constructions, or at least limited by our experiential backgrounds. Does that mean that one experiential background is equally as valid as another to the validity of a theory? In philosophy of science, Doxy argues, the question of a theory's truth or validity takes a utilitarian turn. To quote him, "Whereas the scientific enterprise used to be viewed as the discovery of natural laws, constructivist epistemology led to the view of science as an exercise in constructing systematic models of various aspects of the world and then testing their validity. In this context, validity is a question of utility rather than one of objective truth. No scientific statement of what is can ever be more than an approximation," end quote. Further, the use of metaphors in science offers a parallel to the use of metaphors whenever we speak about the divine. In Doxy's word, quote, "the recognition that knowledge is metaphorical in nature leads to the ecumenical notion that models of reality can differ from each other and still be equally legitimate. In fact, the truth can never be represented definitely by any one model," end quote. Later he says that this epistemological insight, quote, "turned out to be my path to grace," end quote. Doxy's way out of his quandaries over love, then, is to propose his own theory of love, apparently with the idea that since theories are our constructs and that metaphorical models and constructs are allowed in science, and it is the utility of such models for our purposes that constitutes their justification, then it is perfectly acceptable to propose a personal theory of love as having equal claim to our attention as any other theory of love. This is not solipsism, which denies that there is a single reality, but it is a form of monadology in which every person may claim that his theory is equally as valid as any other account for a given reality, because there are no criteria independent of one's own theorizing by which to judge the relative merits of different claims. I do not buy this version of constructivism because it denies the social basis of communication, the linguistic functions of reference and meaning, and the idea that we can develop intersubjective tests of our ideas. Rather, I believe that we can seek truth or a description of human thought in action that is real, not as a copy, but as a form of theoretical knowledge, and that such knowledge is true when it is well confirmed over against alternative theories. But my sense of what is going on in this paper is a public presentation of a deeper struggle between theories viewed as alternatives to one another. One is a theory of how the world works in the church's theology, where Heavenly Father, Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, Satan, and other spiritual beings and forces have causal status and influence in the same way that other persons may influence us in our everyday world. The other is a theory, or a collection of many theories, that restrict causality and influence to a, quote, natural world, and exclude all categories of other than mortal beings as having causal influence. And it matters not whether it is Skinner's behaviorism or Freud's metaphors for personality dynamics. The category of love is constituted as a kind of test case where the particular casting of epistemology allows for a both and something more result rather than an either or. Because the full ontology of the spiritually informed theory of love is lacking, I'm caught a little short in how to address it, but enough is given to suggest an effort to accommodate the LDS notion of universal kindred in the suggestions of universal unity. Quote, not only do we regard God as a loving universal Father, but as his children we recognize each other and all other humans as brothers and sisters. We are therefore obligated to extend our love to all people out of deference for God's love for them. The romantic model of love then makes further sense, even though it is on a slightly different dimension, because it leads to procreation, because woman is derived from man, and because finally it allows for the fuller extension of the eternal kin network. So the notion of an underlying unity, it seems to me, is grounded in this notion of an eternal kinship. Thus, Doxy proposes his conceptualization of love as, quote, the experience of attunement to an underlying unity linking all individuals, end quote. My suggestion is that this result is an effort to resolve the identity struggle cast as a choice between competing theories of the kinds of agents at work in the world, and seeks a both-and resolution rather than an either-or. For me, the definition of love that also results is not fully satisfying because it does not take seriously the radical claim of agape love, of that totally self-giving love without self-interest or without collective cost-benefit. Nor does it fully capture the passion of eros. And in the end, Doxy even introduces love as, quote, a mode of knowing, end quote, in which we engage reality directly rather than as a relational term. Nevertheless, as an example and description of the kinds of identity struggles that we all experience in seeking to reconcile the theoretical understandings of the world that are packaged together with the social identities we acquire, this paper is filled with insight and important personal musings. Clearly, with Doxy and with Alma, I would want to join and sing the song, of redeeming love. Thanks.
We have time for just one or two brief questions, comments. If anybody has any questions or comments, can do that quickly. If not, thanks for coming. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say. I think that the view of love I'm proposing is sort of a switch from traditional ones, and so every aspect of love comes into question. And I'm not sure I could necessarily tell you what the implications would be for each of those aspects. I guess I don't see any of those as, necessarily damning to, what I'm proposing. But they have, they would have different implications. I wanted to just say something about what, in response to what Dr. Hammerberg said about how that I seem to be. I'm not sure what term you said. I wasn't solipsistic, but monadistic or something, yeah. And that because I was, I think there's a trend in a lot of scholarship to try to open up, thinking to a lot of different perspectives, and I guess people are calling that postmodernism, and more the criteria for adjudicating between different positions are being challenged. And so, there is sort of a point where people say, well, do we know anything then? And are there any experts? And I think that to some extent that's a healthy development. But I also, I agree with you. I mean, in one sense, any person can define love as anything they want. But if they don't, if that isn't in common, at least to some degree, with the way other people use the word love, then it doesn't have any meaning anymore, and there's no point in talking. But I think that I just wanted to say that I've done some empirical research to test this conception, and obviously it's not going to convince everybody, no matter what results I get. And I think that's probably true in almost every aspect of social science, at least. But I do think that it's reasonable for people to say, I object to various implications of theories that are predominant in a field, and say, they're starting with assumptions that I can't share, and so I have to go in a different direction. And I think people like Freud and Skinner did that, and that's how they became so important. They said, no, I'm starting with different assumptions, and they started a tradition. Most people who do that don't establish a tradition that goes anywhere, but...
The spiritual reform theory, I think, that needs to take up the kinds of issues that were raised out here. What happens to people in the how are their relations that constitute? And until you really bring in the wider framework, it's hard to know fully what is meant.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming, everyone.
I'm a clinical psychologist as well, and I found it very, very interesting that you would share your personal experience.
Thank you. Great.